Eldon Seufer is a professor in the Department of Philosophy and Classics at the University of Regina. He got his BA and MA from the University of Toronto, 82 and 84 respectively, and his doctorate from the Oxford University in 1988. Among his publications are a textbook he edited on contemporary moral issues and a book he co-authored on the topic of hypocrisy. His most recent work has been on the concept of privacy, and he also serves as an ethicist for the Health Region's Ethics Committee. Eldon is the father of two children, ages 11 and 9. Welcome, Eldon.
Hello, everyone. Let me say first, we don't want feedback, do we? First of all, I was given a choice of topics for today. The other option I was offered was the meaning of happiness. And I guess if I'd been a little more in touch with popular culture, I would have picked that one. Because I've noticed since I made my choice that there was that song by Pharrell Williams called Happy. I don't know if you've heard it, but it includes the line, "Clap along if you feel like happiness is the truth," which seems to me like a very philosophical sort of statement. But anyway, and there's also the happiness challenge, which challenges people to be happy for 100 days in a row. It seems to me if people are doing that, they must already know what happiness is. So if you're among the people doing that, you probably don't need to hear from me about that subject. So I probably chose the right topic anyway. But I chose the tolerance and relativism topic, and so that's what I'm going to talk about today. And I'll start by saying a little bit about tolerance, and then I will spend more time talking about relativism, and then I'll come back to tolerance at the end. So first of all, tolerance or toleration, I'm going to use those interchangeably, seems like a necessary virtue if people are going to get along with each other, live together in any way. But it's also a kind of puzzling thing. There's a well-known article by Bernard Williams, which is called Toleration, an Impossible Virtue, which I'm going to borrow from in what I say today very briefly. Part of what makes it puzzling is that it seems you can only tolerate something if you don't approve of it. It's only something you disapprove of. So if your neighbor is doing something like, I don't know, gardening and making the beautiful flowers easily visible for you, you don't say you tolerate your neighbor's activities. That's just not the right way to describe it. It's only if your neighbor is having rowdy parties or has yippy dogs or, you know, something like that. That's when tolerance comes in. So tolerance seems to involve something that you disapprove of. And then there's the kind of puzzling question of why you are happy to let it continue if you disapprove of it. It seems if you disapprove of it, you should try to stop it. And Williams, in his article, talks a little bit about the religious wars of the 16th and 17th centuries in Europe, which are often seen as ending because there was a growth of tolerance. People became more tolerant of each other's religions. And he suggests maybe that's not exactly the right way to describe it. To some extent, we can understand the fervor of the religious wars if you think of it in these terms. If you really believe that only if you follow the proper religion will your soul be saved, for example, you'll be spared from eternal damnation or something like that, and you care about your neighbors, then it seems you've got an obligation to save your neighbors from that terrible fate. So you have to get them onto the right path. You have to get them following the right religion, for example, or else you're ignoring your obligation to help them. You're allowing them to just go blithely off on the road to destruction, which shouldn't be what you do. So, and of course, many people thought they had to use force if necessary to get people onto the right path, and that was part of the reason that we ended up with wars. But it kind of makes sense if you think about it that way. It's not such an obvious failing. You're trying to help the other person by forcing them to follow the right religion and in that mindset. And the way people were able to end many of the wars over that, I'm not saying all fighting over religion has stopped, of course, but the way many people were able to get past that was not so much tolerance, I'm not sure that's the right description, but more coming to a view that maybe there isn't just one correct path to God, for example. Some people thought God will accept you as long as you're making a good-natured attempt. Even if your path isn't exactly the right one, God will be forgiving. Or maybe that religions really have so much in common that all these people are essentially on the same path, so the differences between religions aren't that important. But it's only if you have those sorts of beliefs that you can think that allowing people to follow their own religion is consistent with the concern that you have for the eternal soul of your neighbor. And so really, in a way, the end of the religious wars is a little bit different than what we would normally think of as tolerance. Anyway, as I said, I'm going to return to tolerance, but I want to talk more about relativism. So let me switch to that for a bit now. Specifically, when I talk about relativism, I have in mind something which is known in philosophy as cultural ethical relativism. You can be relativist about lots of different things, but what I have in mind is a view which starts from the observation that people in different places seem to have different beliefs about ethics. That's kind of the starting point. And often people have noticed that if some people thought they had the right views and thought that other views were wrong, they decided they would try to get the other people to change, and they often did things in the effort to try to get other people to change that, looking back on it, we think were pretty terrible. There were a lot of awful things done in the name of that kind of, especially if they had the power to try to force others to do it their way instead. And so some people have drawn the conclusion from this that we should be more modest about our beliefs, that we have our beliefs, we have our reasons for having our beliefs, but we should also recognize that other people have different beliefs and they must have reasons for having their beliefs as well. And often people then draw a conclusion which is the beliefs of others are just as valid as our own beliefs. And we should tolerate them. We should not try to impose our own view on others, but we should tolerate the views of others. And this leads in turn to the view I'm calling cultural ethical relativism, which is the view that there aren't any objective universal truths about ethics. There's nothing that is just true across the board when it comes to ethics. There are different people's beliefs about ethics, and each community's views are as correct as each other community's views. It's equally right, if you want to think of it that way. And so the view really says that what is right for an individual is always going to depend on what that individual's culture thinks is right. So what is right for an individual is whatever that individual's culture thinks is right. And it may be different from what an individual in a different culture would have as the truth, as it were, but that doesn't really matter. There is no universal right answer. There's only this community's truth, that community's truth, and so on. And that's the notion of relativism that I want to talk about. Now, the view, as I've described it, I think seems fairly appealing, but to a philosopher, it needs defense just as much as any other view does. And there are reasons to think that it might not be right. Now, one reason which comes to mind, which I'm not going to spend much time on, is just that we sometimes run into beliefs which are held in some cultures or communities that we find intolerable. And that suggests maybe there's a limit to how much we should tolerate. And that's back to the same idea. If you really think something is wrong, why should you tolerate it? So if another society is treating some of its members in an unequal way, or if it is exercising violence in ways that we think are not appropriate, it's not obvious that we should tolerate that. But I have kind of more systematic ways to go about challenging this. So, first of all, let me go back to the starting point. The starting point for the theory, as I described it, was that people in different communities have different beliefs about ethics. Well, some people would say, maybe that's not as true as it appears to be. Maybe right there, the case has been overstated. So let's take an example, and it's just a hypothetical example. But suppose that there's a community which practices cannibalism. And suppose that I come from a community that doesn't think cannibalism is a very good thing, and I have a conversation with somebody from that other community. And I say to this person, why do you engage in this practice of cannibalism? And the person says, well, I'll tell you, it's fairly straightforward. We believe that if we eat the bodies of our conquered enemies, let's say, that will convey some magical powers to us that will enable us to protect our families. Okay? Now, where is my disagreement with that person? That person is saying, I'm going to do something to try to protect my family. Do I think that's ethically wrong, that we should avoid doing things to protect our family? No, of course not. That's a value I agree with. I accept the value that you want to protect your families. Where we disagree is in the belief that eating that dead body is going to accomplish that purpose. Right? That's not something that I happen to believe. But that's not really an ethical matter. That's a matter of, you know, empirical truth, we might say. Is it the case that engaging in this action will have that effect, or is it not? So it turns out our disagreement there may not be an ethical disagreement at all. It's a disagreement about what the consequences of a certain action will be. It's a matter of what actually happens in the world, not about ethics. So what looked like a very serious disagreement about values may turn out to be a disagreement about something else. We share the values that we should do things to protect our family. We just disagree about what's going to be effective to bring that about. So sometimes what look like different ethical views in different cultures really aren't that. They're something different. Now, that doesn't establish that all differences are like that. Maybe some are, some aren't, and so on. But it's at least one way to wonder about the relativist position. But let me go on to the next step. So let's suppose that there really are these disagreements about ethics between different cultures. Now, the argument seems to go, people disagree about ethics, therefore there are no right answers about ethics, or each is equally right. But if you think of that in terms of the structure of the argument, I think it's pretty easy to see that that's not a very good argument. Right? If we just put X in for ethics. People disagree about X, therefore there is no right answer about X. Is that a good structure of argument? Doesn't seem to be. So people disagree about the shape of the earth, for example. Some people think it's round, some people think it's flat. And by the way, there still is a Flat Earth Society. You can find their webpage. They're deprogramming the masses since 1543, I think is their slogan. But in any case, so we have this disagreement about the shape of the earth. Do we conclude, therefore, there is no right answer about the shape of the earth and each answer is equally right? Probably not. Most of us would think some of those people may be right and others might be wrong. Or similarly, if we had, I don't know, say I'm not very good at multiplication and I asked some people what's 783 times 727 or whatever, and I get three different answers. Do I say, well, I guess you're all equally right? No, of course not. I don't conclude that. So the mere fact that people disagree about things doesn't mean that they're all equally right or that there's no right answer about it. So usually the response to that is, okay, but ethics is different, right? There's something different about ethical disagreement than about disagreement in multiplication, for example. What is that difference? How are we going to characterize that? Well, the usual answer is, well, we can test the results of multiplication. We can prove one thing, not the other. Even with the shape of the earth, we can prove it. We have measures we can use, and maybe we don't have measures available for ethics. Well, the first thing I want to say about that is there's always a question of what counts as proof. What really counts as proof? And, you know, in philosophy, we say the evidence of our senses can be doubted. I mean, there are all kinds of levels of question about proof. But even beyond that, let's take another example. I use this in my classes often. Suppose you and a friend are driving down the road one day, and you see an animal by the side of the road, and then you zip on down the highway. And then a little bit later, your friend says, it was kind of funny seeing that wolverine by the side of the road back there. And you say to your friend, that wasn't a wolverine, it was a badger. And you think, okay, we better sort this out. So you go back to the spot and you explore, and you can't find proof one way or another about what kind of animal it was. So, do you then conclude that it was both a wolverine and a badger? That there's no right answer about what animal it was? Of course not. You think, at most, one of you is right. Of course, it's possible you were both wrong. But let's just assume, at most, one of you was right about that. The mere fact that people believe different things and that they can't prove that one is right and the other is wrong doesn't settle the matter. There could still be a right answer. It's just that in that case, we're not sure what that right answer is. But that's a different matter. Okay? So, as I say, the argument as it stands isn't really convincing. It doesn't establish that this relativist view is right, the view that says there is no right answer, or that each answer is equally right. There are other problems as well with relativism as I've described it. So, one sort of problem, the way I put it, is what's right for an individual is whatever that individual's culture thinks is right. So, here's my next question. What's a culture? And it's not a small little question. It turns out that's a very difficult question to answer. So, what culture do you belong to? It's a baffling question. How many cultures do you belong to? You might have a religious culture, you might have an ethnic heritage, you might have a national culture, you might have a lifestyle culture, you might have some pastime you engage in that has a culture of its own, maybe your curlers and curling cultures, whatever. There can be a million different things that we could count as cultures. So if you're trying to figure out what's the right thing to do, and you're told, the right thing to do is what my culture thinks is right, where do you turn? How do you settle that? Whose opinions are you seeking to try to find out what you're supposed to do? So the very way of framing that question turns out to be sort of problematic. And even if we get beyond that, even if we know what a culture is, I think we've still got a kind of related problem. How do we know what it is that the culture believes? The claim was, what's right for you is whatever your culture thinks is right. How do you know what the culture thinks? Does it have to be the case that everybody within that culture thinks it? Or could there be some people who disagree? Would that ruin the thought that the culture thinks it? And if some can disagree, how many people can disagree? Do we need 90% of the people to agree? 75%? 50% plus one? What if there are three or four different beliefs? What percentage have to... It turns out that it's going to be really difficult to figure out what a culture believes. So defining relativism in terms of what the culture believes is going to be problematic. Now, one way to go from that is you could say, maybe we should ignore or abandon cultural ethical relativism, which I've been describing, and we should go to individual ethical relativism. So individual ethical relativism still says there is no right answer about ethics. There are no universal truths when it comes to ethics. What is right for an individual, I will say, is whatever that individual thinks is right. Whatever you think is right for you. Most people don't find that a very appealing view. Right? If there is somebody who says, well, I think I should torture and kill children, we'd say, oh, okay, that's right for you. Really? It seems like a very odd thing to say. Now, it could, of course, be right for me to punish you for doing that, even if it's right for you to do it. But it just gets very confusing. It's hard to believe that we can take seriously that notion of individual relativism, that whatever you think is fine. Let me mention another problem, which actually applies to both cultural and individual relativism, which is we tend to think that people can change their minds about ethical issues, that we can get new views developing. But it's hard to see how that could ever happen if relativism is the view that we should take about ethics. And to explain why that's true, just think it through. So let's take it on the cultural level. Most people in this culture, whatever this culture is, have a particular belief. That view is, by definition, right. Okay? That's what relativism says. Whatever they believe is right. whatever view they would be changing to, they'd be changing to something that they don't think is right, which means they'd be changing to a view which is, by definition, wrong. Because what's right is what they believe. Everything they don't believe is wrong. What possible reason could there be for changing from the right view to a wrong view? Doesn't make any sense. So views should stay exactly the same. Cultures should remain unchanged. Individuals should never change their minds if relativism is correct. That's kind of an absurd consequence, right? It's hard to believe. So these were a number of problems. Now, finally, I want to return to tolerance a little bit. I had noted at the beginning that a lot of people are drawn to relativism by a notion that we need to tolerate others' beliefs. And relativism seems like a way of tolerating other people's beliefs. Seems to give us some explanation of what's going on when we should do that. But I want to claim that that way of arriving at relativism is flawed also. There's flawed reasoning involved in this process. And it's actually fairly easy to see why that's true. So the claim was, we should tolerate others' beliefs. Now here's my question. What's the status of that claim? The claim that we should tolerate others' beliefs. It's a should term. It seems like an ethical term. It actually seems like an objective, universal, ethical truth is being put out there. The truth of the matter is that people should tolerate the views of others. But relativism is a view that says there aren't any absolute, objective, universal, ethical truths. So it can't be. So what should a relativist say about this? Well, of course, what a relativist should say is, if your culture happens to support tolerance, then you should tolerate other groups. But if your culture doesn't, then you shouldn't. Right? That's exactly what the relativist is going to say about this. So if you really do value this notion that you should tolerate others' views, it's probably going to be on much firmer foundations if you say that there is an objective ethical principle which says that we should respect others. We could put it, I guess I'm thinking of Kantian terms here, but it doesn't have to be. We should respect others as autonomous agents who can choose for themselves how to lead their lives. We have to have respect for others in that regard, but that's an absolute claim. This is a claim about what ethics really requires. And if somebody says, well, I don't happen to agree with that, or somebody says, my culture doesn't accept that, we don't think we have to respect people. We say, well, your culture's wrong. They've made a mistake in that case. So in fact, the inclination that I think often draws people to relativism is based on a mistake. If they really think it through clearly, they might not be as drawn to relativism. Now, of course, there's more to be said about all of this. This is philosophy after all. But I guess my main suggestion here is, if you want to be a relativist, you should be aware that you've got a number of hurdles to overcome. It's not the straightforward, comfortable fallback position. And, you know, I get this all the time. I get students who are writing a paper on, let's say, abortion, and they say, well, here are the arguments for abortion, here are the arguments against the abortion, and then their conclusion is, so we'll never really know which side is right. They're both equally right. And I say, how do you know that conclusion is right? Just because they're the different arguments, the different positions? It's not such an easy fallback position that you can just assume, well, let's comfortably land on everybody's equally right. That in itself needs quite a bit of defense and has some problems to overcome. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you, Eldon. I bet there'll be questions. Yes, just a few. Okay, I'll go around like this.
And this, I guess, has to do with nations and what they do. Okay. Seymour Hersh recently, you know, the well-known journalist, said that it appears that the Turks and Al-Qaeda were behind the sarin gas attack in Syria. Hmm. And there seems to be quite a bit of evidence that that's true. It looked like the world was almost ready to go to war or something, more war than there is, because the West said it wasn't true. Does it make any difference what side is right? And then if the media gets in on one side and everybody believes the one side compared to the other, so what do we say? Just so what?
Well, I mean, first of all, I was suggesting there can be absolute ethical truths, and there's no obvious reason why we say just so what in that case. We could say this is wrong if something is wrong. We don't have to say that's what you thought was right, so it's fine. I'm trying to free up space to say that's wrong. Traditionally, of course, the view was that independent sovereign nations could make their own decisions about what they were going to do, and others, for the most part, were supposed to stay out of it. In the 20th century, things turned a bit, and we can talk about why it turned, but there came to be this notion that there are worldwide standards that apply, and that maybe there should be somebody, first the League of Nations, then the United Nations, and various other international courts and so on, that can serve as referees, as it were. And in doing so, they are, to some extent, imposing conceptions of the way things should work. So we get rights that every nation is supposed to recognize and so on. And part of the reason for that is that people want to have a kind of principled way to intervene if something goes wrong, so that they're not just using their force because they don't happen to like something, but they can appeal to these standards. But of course, we also know there's an element of realpolitik, there's an element of trying to sell it to the masses and so on. So if you can persuade your own people that you've got right on your side, they'll support your military efforts or whatever they may be. And sometimes that isn't because right really is on your side, it's just because you can make a plausible case for it. So I'm not saying that the international community has solved all these problems by any stretch. But at least that's supposed to be the framework of how it works. I don't know if that addresses your question, but it's kind of the best I can do, I think.
Are you saying then that there's no basic thread of tolerance through any cultures, and that there's no really right or wrong, and that we should not strive for those principles? Is that just a failing of us as a species?
I don't think I said those things, although maybe they're in there. I wasn't trying to give an analysis of every culture and what its views have been. I was just trying to think through the implications of particular claims. And I actually think that there is a notion of respect for others which could be understood as tolerance. I don't think it has always been present in European culture, which I guess is where philosophy has its home, and probably not always been present in other cultures either, although I think some may have had more of it than others. And I'm inclined to think that that's right, that that's the way we should view things. Some people think that we've made progress towards that over the years. And, part of the process of getting rid of slavery and then having equal rights for women and, various things like that, the progress might be towards improving our understanding of that kind of recognition of others as autonomous beings and the need to respect them. So I guess I'm an optimist, and I actually do think that maybe we'll make progress and that this is a value that we should be aiming for. But whether that's a well-founded optimism, I don't know. Will that do?
Okay. Thinking about cannibalism, seems to me there's a big ethical difference if you eat an enemy that's already dead anyhow, than if it's different from going to a different tribe, killing someone because you want to eat them for the sake of your family.
Okay.
Is that right?
Yeah, okay, fair enough. So here we've got a question of competing values. So we might agree with whoever this other person is that we're talking to, that it's ethically appropriate to protect our families. But we might disagree about how important that is compared with other values. So even if I thought it was true that killing somebody would provide some measure of protection for my family, I might think, but I shouldn't do that, because killing is really bad. And I'm just not allowed to do that, even if it's going to have this good effect. Whereas somebody else might say, this is the good effect I care about. Killing isn't that big a deal. Why wouldn't I go ahead and do that? So maybe we do have relativism there. Maybe we agree on the values. We agree killing is bad. We agree protecting the family is right. We disagree about how to balance those. And that's a possibility.
Thanks. Two points. One is that in terms of relativism, you talked about what is a culture, but then what is an individual? I mean, individual, I have different opinions on different days about a lot of, not maybe fundamental, but certainly different. Another good example about, like Dave's example was like the Ukraine. This is a very confusing thing. And I can see pro and con arguments in many aspects of this. And I think it's partly because we do make relative decisions, we do make cultural decisions, we do make a whole bundle of decisions. We don't split things out into philosophical aspects and cultural aspects and personal aspects and, you know, my relatives live their aspects. We bundle it. So, and then our government might fly some jets over to sort of get really, really militaristic because that's how their approach is. And that's Canadian somehow because I live here. So, like, I know it's my culture is not that one. But anyway, so what I'm saying is there is a huge amount of relativism in our thinking, and there's a huge amount of complexity, which is typically hard to address in realpolitik, as you called it.
That there's a lot that's hard to express, absolutely. No doubt about it. And your point, I was trying to say, if we've got a problem for cultural relativism, maybe we can solve it with individual relativism. Maybe you're right. Maybe that doesn't solve it, because we still have a problem of what's an individual. That's fine. If I had talked about the other topic, the one I didn't talk about, I would have talked about utilitarianism. And one problem that's often raised for utilitarianism is it says we're supposed to maximize happiness, but how in the world do you do that? And it seems like we don't have it. And people often talk as if we had some convenient numbers for happiness, but of course we don't. But the usual utilitarian response to that is, you're absolutely right, we don't have the numbers and it's mysterious how we could possibly do it, but we do it all the time. We make these decisions, and sometimes it's as simple as, you know, what am I going to order for supper at the restaurant? Well, I'm going to make a prediction about what is going to make me happier at some level. How I do that, I don't know. Some days I do one thing and sometimes I do another, and it's hard to figure out why I am confident this is the thing. And of course, sometimes I think I got it wrong. Oh, I should have ordered the whatever. But somehow or other, we make those decisions, and we do it interpersonally as well. We decide what's going to be best for this group, and we go ahead and do it. And so I think it's puzzling how any decisions are made, but I'm not sure what that tells us about relativism in particular. Relativism is the view that there is no right answer, right? That's the notion I'm thinking of. It's a version of what's sometimes called non-cognitivism. But there's no universal right answer, but there is a right answer for some particular individual or group. That's really the view that I was taking as my topic. And the fact that we have a difficult time figuring out what the answer is doesn't necessarily prove that there is no right answer. And that was the major step I was trying to make, I guess. Okay?
Thank you, Eldon. Several years ago now, I think I did a presentation called Intolerance as a Virtue.
Oh, yeah.
A challenge to the first principle, which is the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And it was based somewhat, or initiated somewhat, on my reading of a book by Bruce Bauer, While Europe Slept. And I've forgotten the subtitle, but it had to do with how democracy in Europe is threatened because they were ignoring what was happening with the Muslim immigration. And the fact that many of the Muslim people are moving into France, for example, have no intention of becoming acculturated to the French community, but eventually hoped to supplant it. And some were actually wearing T-shirts that said, "The year 2032, or pardon me, 2032, the year we take over." Mm. And he focused on all of, you know, things like the honor killings and all of those things that we ought not to tolerate, and that there should be some universal values that we strive for. He also wrote another book called Surrender, which focused on the fact that many of the media are so caught up in this idea of political correctness that they were not, again, defending some of our values and thereby threatening them for these other initiatives. So, again, I think we ought to strive for the fact that there should be or could be some universal values that we have to encourage and hope that others will learn to accept them well. And maybe the challenge is to determine what could be considered a universal value that everyone ought to strive for.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I'm inclined to believe that there are universal values. And I'm also, I guess, committed to the idea that if we reason our way through things, we'll get closer to figuring out what those are. I actually do think we can make progress on this, partly by the kind of argument that I've tried to offer here. If I'm right that there is a principle that says something like, you know, we should respect others as autonomous agents who are able to make their decisions about how to live their lives, something along those lines, then, first of all, that's one ethical view, but it may come into conflict with other ethical views, and so that'll place some limits on it. But also, it may, in a way, place its own limits on things. So if there is somebody who has a practice which doesn't respect others as autonomous beings, I have a reason to not respect their ability to make that choice. Right? If somebody is oppressing, killing, whatever, I have a reason to not respect that because of this same principle that says we need to respect the autonomy of others. So in some ways, I think that may be a tool we can use to argue that this view really is better than that view, and here's the limit of tolerance. Here's stuff that we should tolerate, and here's other stuff that we shouldn't.
And I'll just have the last question. I almost hate to do this because I want to simplify everything. And I know you don't do that with philosophy.
It's not so, my natural tendency, no.
So, but I do thank you for coming and causing us to really think. All the while you were talking, I was trying to formulate an absolute moral truth. Wow. So... I may be opening a can of worms for you, but I keep thinking about the golden rule and do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And is that an absolute moral truth that we can espouse, which will never happen, but
I think we probably have to word that a little differently than the common wording. I mean, the classic counterexample is a masochist who thinks it's absolutely all right to cause physical pain to others because they don't mind people causing physical pain to them, and that's not really what it means, right? So we need to be more careful about how we're going to word it. But I'm not sure it's that different from what I said. Respect others as autonomous agents who can decide how they want to lead their lives, and the reason for that may be because I want to be treated as an autonomous agent, and so we have that in common. And some people would put this in terms of treat people with respect or treat people equally, or there might be different elements and different formulations. But I think a lot of people think there's something like that that is a core principle in ethics, that seems like the right way forward.
I was wrong. That was the second last question. This would be the last question.
Hi. So we agree that there's lots of different opinions and groups of people. But what are some of the effective tools that can be used to confine, like, to create a common agreement so people can get along? And maybe what are your thoughts on consensus decision making?
Well, let me say, first of all, I'm committed to communicating, right? I mean, I think that's a basic thing. I think if people have conversations and express their views, so we need conditions in which people feel free to express their views. We need people who are skilled at listening to other views and understanding what they are open to challenging their own assumptions and so on. I'm inclined to think that a liberal arts education should provide all of those things, and I'm inclined to think that universities are drifting farther and farther away from that. So I'm not convinced that people usually get that in universities, but that's going to be the start for me. I mean, I think that's going to be really a core for any kind of governing principles, that people have those kinds of civic virtues, as they're sometimes called, those abilities to communicate with each other. I think that people are also going to sometimes have to settle for something they're not entirely comfortable with. And as I said, tolerance involves letting something go even though you can't. Now, one reason why you would let something go ahead even though you think it's wrong is because you don't have the power to stop it. And sometimes people just realistically say, we don't have enough power to get those other people to stop doing this, so we better let them go. That's not always bad. But sometimes it's also that doing everything I could to stop it would be morally worse than what they're doing in the first place. So in that case, I think you hear this sort of thing in free speech discussions, for example. Somebody wants to say something that you think is wrong, still you might want to defend their right to say it, because the bringing in the machinery of stopping people from speaking would be much worse than letting them say the bad thing. Now, I don't know if that gets anywhere near consensus. I guess when all is said and done, I don't think we can always get consensus. I think it's a nice sort of dream people aim for in meetings of various sorts, but I don't think it's realistic. I think there just are going to be disagreements, and we have to acknowledge that and find ways to keep going anyway. There's a lot to be said about democracy, and I don't just mean democracy as we have it. It's not obvious that what we have really is democracy. We may need something much more participatory, giving voice to people who now don't really have a voice, getting some of the money and all of that out of it and so on. But I think talking about democracy in detail would take me too far from my theme today. But I do have some optimism that democracy of some sort is a possibility and something that we should work towards. But I'm not sure that amounts to consensus. I guess the last thing I'll say, I'll give the last word to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who happens to be a kind of favorite of mine. He's a very odd life and fascinating character, but I really like him. And from his point of view, part of what has to happen if you're going to form a society is that people have to identify with the group more than they're concerned about their own interests. So you really have to think of others as being part of your group, and whatever damages any member of the group is going to damage you and so on. And so there has to be some kind of change in thinking, a little bit less individualistic and more in terms of community, which enables people to live together. And I guess I'm tempted by something along those lines as well. Thanks. Thank you.